Accession number 30649, Mr. Ted Hill, Reel 7. Now, we were talking about, you went back, you were doing these working up exercises. This is just the ship working up, not working up as part of a fleet.
No, the ship working up. And this always happened after a refit, an extended refit, to make sure everything worked as it should, and all the various exercises we used to do as well that I've just described. The upper deck would be doing their sort of things, like gunnery and whatever. I mean, they used to call it evolutions. You know, the captain had broadcast, or someone had broadcast, man overboard, and they'd chuck something over the side, and they'd call away a sea boat and go and rescue this little wooden barrel they'd chucked over the side.
But you as stokers wouldn't do that?
No.
You'd get your own.
If it was a power boat, there'd be a stoker on it to man the engine. If it was a sea boat, a rowing boat, whaler, that would be all seamen.
So what happens next then? You're working up, based at Hong Kong.
And then we came to the bit which we'd all talked about for months, that we start the summer cruise. And the summer cruise in the Far East, especially on the Belfast being the flagship, you'd go to Japan and you'd go to the main ports all round Japan, starting from Sasebo at the bottom to Yokohama and Yokosuka, which was the big American. Well, the Americans were everywhere anyway, but their main naval base was Yokosuka and Yokohama, Kobe, Curie, which was Australian, and another big port on the inland sea. They'd do all those places, and they'd go to the Philippines and Australia and New Zealand and Pacific Islands. You know, and it was a great 4 or 5 months, you know, showing the flag and being entertained ashore. Because all these places you used to go, they'd get requests, you know, send 10 sailors to whatever, big booze up and barbecue or whatever. But unfortunately, we were going to start a British base up in North Japan, and we went to this place called Ominato.
Do you know how you spell it?
O-M-I-N-A-T-O. And we were there for about 10 or 12 days.
Now, what were you doing? How do you set up a British base? Do you see what I mean?
Well, there was this lovely bay. I mean, if you can imagine a U-shaped bay going in, the bottom of the U, there was a village. And at the top of the U, there was an old airfield. And it was about 7 or 8 miles round the bay between the village and the airfield. But this old airfield, we were going to rig it out as a British base, like a visiting base where they could go to a canteen ashore. And we did some work. I mean, we were there for 12 days, according to this log. And we started cutting up. The engineers started hacking out some of the hangars and living accommodation on this old airbase. And this village, which was the only place to go ashore, they wouldn't land us at the village. The ship's boat. We were at anchor in the middle of the bay. They wouldn't land us. They would collect us from the village if we landed at the airfield and walked 8 miles round the bay. Well, we, all the stokers said, well, it must be blinking good at the village if they're trying to keep us away. So we did walk round there a couple of times, and it was great. You know, they fed us, and we had to pay for it. The real old traditional geisha houses where you were entertained by these one-string fiddles and dancing and drink and food. And it was so cheap. because it was a little village in the middle of nowhere. Never seen a British warship before. I remember an incident. They wanted some replacement oxyacetylene and oxygen bottles ashore for cutting the steelwork in these old hangars. And the stokers were delegates. It was our department doing it. So the pinnace was over the side and they brought it alongside the boat deck. And they wanted, it was an oxygen bottle. And the old crane driver closed up into his place. And to direct him, you say up purchase or down purchase or left purchase or... Anyway, he brought the hook over to this gas bottle. An old Digby Gurr, a friend of mine, he said, we need a loop on here. So he went and got a bit of what we called spun yarn, hairy ginger string it was, and made a loop around this top of this bottle. And someone said, I'll never pick that up, Digby. Of course it will. It's ever so strong, this stuff. So anyway, he hooked it on the crane, up purchase, it lifted the bottle, it took it over the side, and that's where it broke. And luckily, it hit the gunwale, the side of the boat, rather than, if it had gone in the boat, going straight down, it had just gone straight through it. But it hit the gunwale, did a lot of damage to it, and bounced in the water. So they called out the diver. And the diver was a stoker, old Pash Baker, and sent him down. Well, old Pash used to tell us on the mess deck, especially us young kids, you know, the trials and tribulations of a diver. Well, they used to get extra pay per day, something like a shilling a day. But when they were actually diving, they got an hourly rate of pay. So if they were looking for something on the bottom, like this gas bottle, when they found it, they sat on it for a couple of hours, waggling the hoses a bit now and again to make it look as if they're moving. And he sat there, old Pash, and he told me this afterwards. He sat there and the valve stuck on his helmet, because these were the old traditional diving suits, the great big things with a great big helmet. The valve stuck and it blew his suit up. And we were all watching, you know, and suddenly old Pash came flying out the water like Superman, half out the water before he crashed back, and he was laying like this, stretched out,
spread eagled,
with it spread eagled, with his suit expanded full of compressed air. And there was a big panic, because he'd come up too far, he would get the bend. So the chief diver was called, and they sorted his suit out very quickly, this valve. And the chief diver got dressed and took him back down to the bottom very quickly. And they had to bring him up in stages. It took an hour, no longer than that. Hour and a half, 2 hours to bring him up. And he luckily didn't get the bends, old Pash. But it's something we all remember. That incident.
Did they ever get the bottle back?
Oh yeah, yeah. The chief diver took down a rope and hooked it on. But from there, we spent 12 days there, and then we went to the city and port of Hokodate, which is spelt H-A-K-O-D-A-L. T-E.
O-D-A-L-T-E.
Yeah. H-A-K-O-D-A-T-E. Hokodate.
Now, where's that? Near...
That's near Ominato. It's up north Japan. One of the northernmost ports, Hokodate. It's a big port. And we all went ashore there, and the date was the 8th of June 1950. Now, if you've been interviewing Korean veterans, you know that was the time when the Korean War started, because we were there, I don't know, a couple of days. And one evening they sent out the recall to bring all the people ashore back. You know, they flew the flags and sounded the hooter and sent patrols ashore to round everybody up. And we sailed from there back to Yokosuka.
Now, what did everyone think when they heard that war had broken out, you know? Well, it was just with North
Korea
then. Well,
initially, we didn't know anything. And then we heard that there was a civil war starting in Korea. The North, the communist North, was invading the South. And, you know, we thought it's going to be a police action. But we went down to Yokosuka, which is the American base, and from there we went down to Okinawa, where the Americans, because it was all organised by the Americans, collected a fleet, and we went up to do a first strike, or we thought we were doing a first strike against the North Koreans, who were rapidly going south.
Now, what do you remember of that strike?
Well,
was it bombardment or was it just air?
No, it was both. Air and bombarding. HMS Jamaica was already up there. And she took a hammering, but she did virtually wipe out the North Korean Navy, which was only about half a dozen patrol boats at that time. And she was heavily shelled and damaged, the Jamaica. Lots of casualties on there. Boy seamen as well were casualties. And we joined this fleet at Okinawa and went up. And I remember they broadcast that the Americans were going to launch the first airstrike. And we all went outside to have a look, you know. And the first couple of planes, we were next to an American aircraft carrier. It was on our port side. And the first couple of planes they launched went straight in a drink, straight off the end of the flight deck into the drink, which there must have been a technical reason, because they, in those days, they were using helicopters. An aircraft carrier would have a helicopter on each side of it flying, and if a plane went in the drink, which depending which side of the ship it went down, that helicopter would stop. So when the ship had passed, they was right on top of the aeroplane and get the people out. We were still using, for our aircraft carriers, a destroyer sort of half a mile behind the carrier. So if a plane went in the water, it was quite a time before the destroyer got there to try and rescue people. But it went ahead. It didn't make a terrible lot of difference, because the communists kept going until they'd taken virtually all of South Korea. There was only a little bit at the bottom left. But by that time, the United Nations had got organized. The Americans poured thousands and thousands of men in. We'd brought troops up from Hong Kong. There was a big army contingent at Hong Kong. They were brought up. And the fight back started from there, right down at the foot of Korea, which is a peninsula. Now, I've often thought about the naval role, because all we did was bombard. I mean, we were a gun platform. I mean, so much so, we wore out the gun barrels at one point and had to nip down to Singapore and put new ones on and go back up.
Now, what you I know you're a stoker, so I know limited perspective, but what do you remember of the shore bombardments?
Well, they got routine. I mean, in the end, we didn't even go to action stations for bombarding. We went to action stations every morning at daybreak, well, before daybreak, So as day broke, the ship was fully at action stations. Now that happened every day you were on the Korean coast. But the bombardments, I mean, they would broadcast, we would be bombarding to port or to starboard with the 6-inch turrets from whatever time, you know. But those 6-inch guns, I know they're Mark 23 6-inch guns firing a shell that weighs 112 pounds, which is nothing really. Well, that rated Belfast as a light cruiser because 6-inch are termed as light guns. And the term heavy cruiser and light cruiser is nothing to do with the weight of the ship. It's to do with the size of the guns. 6-inch are small, so they're light. But they've only got an accurate range of 14¾ miles. So you imagine if we're a mile or two off the coast, you can only fire in so far. And on our coast, the American battleships never came to the west coast because it was full of islands and reefs and all that. So it was a very dangerous place for big ships. So the only big ships that went up there, well, ships of any size, was the Belfast and the other British cruisers like Ceylon and Jamaica and such like, Kenya. The American battleships used to be on the east coast, which is deep water right up to the cliffs. So we could only fire in, you know, say 13 miles inland. So you think of a peninsula a couple of hundred miles wide, the Navy could only do the edges, really. Except the American battleships, they went about 22 miles, the big guns. But they were big guns. I mean, the difference between the Belfast 6-inch shell, which weighed 112 pounds, as opposed to a 15, 16-inch shell, which weighed a ton. So a full broadside from the Belfast was 1,200 weights, which is a bit over half a ton. One shell from a battleship was nearly twice that. So it's why it was a light cruiser.
Did anything ever happen while? What was it like while you were bombarding?
Well, occasionally we'd go outside and have a look. You know, when we wasn't at action stations. If we went to action stations for bombardment, you know, I mean, the whole ship was battened down and you were wherever. I was usually on damage control party. The forward part of the ship, there was about a dozen, 15 of us stokers.
So you wouldn't be in C, I've forgotten the A, but you wouldn't be in your A boiler room, you'd be in this damage control.
Well, it depends. If you were on watch, there would be an action watch, and they would come and relieve you, and you'd go to your action station. If A boiler room wasn't your action station, it would be somewhere else, and you would be relieved and go to it.
So your action station was in the forward control party.
The forward damage forward, control sorry. Party. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. So tell me what you did with that then.
Well, we had a muster place, which was at B gun barbette on the main deck, which is the compartment just forward of the canteen. And we operated from there. I mean, there was never an occasion where we were used in anger, except once when we pulled in for the night in the Munksey Islands, dropped the anchor, reduced steam to 1, 2, or 3 hours notice, and all settled down. And during the day or during the night, the communists had brought a little gun over onto one of these islands. But it was a 3.5-inch shell in metric, about 80 millimetre, I think it was. And they started firing at us. Well, I can remember I was on the boat deck with a lot of other people and suddenly I heard this noise. And it was a noise, you never forget the sound of it, of a shell passing overhead, but fairly close. It sort of went as it went over the top. And there was probably a quarter of a mile out to sea from the ship. There was this great big splash. And we were all discussing what it was, you know, whether it was a shark or a whale blowing. And suddenly there was a big bang on the starboard side and we'd been hit. And they called action station straight away. Well, that was within our action station. And we went to the compartment, which was the Chinese steward's mess deck, which we never went down normally. But this was early evening it happened. And the only one that was killed was a Chinese steward was in his hammock, where he shouldn't have been at that time of the day. His hammock shouldn't have been up, but they they probably did what they liked to the Chinese mess deck. And it hit a steam line, this shell, or burst the steam line, right over his hammock. So he did die. He was scalded to death. And there was a hole in the side, about a foot square, where the shell had burst through, which it was quite a long way above the waterline, you know, probably 10 or 12 feet. So it was no immediate danger, but we did plug it.
Now, how'd you plug it?
But we kept, well,
the way you told us.
Yeah, padded it over and shored it up, we would. But we didn't do that initially because right by it was this bloke who was scalded in his hammock and all the medical people were there sorting him out. First priority. When they got him out the way, we plugged the hole more or less for exercise, because later on the shipwrights came down after all the fuss had blown over and we'd gone from, because they called up the guns and the 4-inch guns took out this gun that had fired at us and it all went quiet, so the shipwrights came down and cut the hole bigger, you know, to get rid of all the bent base, put a new bit of plate in and welded it in, you know, same evening. So that was all okay, but this, he was the only casualty killed, this Charlie Lee Sue.
And it was just the one hit?
One hit, yeah.
Anything else happened while you were bombarding?
Not that I remember. And there must have been things happened around the ship, but you don't hear them all, you know. This one I was involved with. There was a few near misses that day. You know, they were going over the top initially. And I suppose, like us, they do ranging shots and found they were going too far and adjusted it and hit us first go.
But the 4-inch ones, why not the 6-inch?
Well, it was so close. It's only about half a mile away, this island. They could have took it on with machine guns, probably, at that distance. But they didn't. But when they called action stations, the whole lot closed up anyway, the 6-inch and the 4-inch. But they decided, I don't know, to use the 4-inch.
And it worked.
And it worked, yeah.
Now, were you nervous when you were under fire, or was it? Did you feel safe on a big ship like that?
Oh, you felt safe. And when you're 17, nothing's going to happen to you.
You genuinely believe that?
What? Yeah. I mean, it was a big adventure to us, really. And the only people I saw who were really frightened when we first started bombarding was the Chinese cooks and stewards, officers, cooks and stewards. And I remember I was at the Barbette, B Barbette, that was our action station for the forward damage control party. And these Chinese blokes came past us crawling on the floor, on the deck, right in the corner. as if they were, you know, cowering out the way. And they were going off somewhere. I don't know where they were going. But they wouldn't have got, well, they were having a job getting anywhere, really, because all the doors were shut. And you had to get permission to open doors. But the chief in our section opened the doors and let them through. He said, we don't. He probably thought, you know, they might get us panicky if they're that bad. But we had to bury the bloke that day. Actually, that night.
Was there a big ceremony, the old burial at sea ceremony? Do you remember it?
No, you can't. They can't be buried at sea, Chinese. Their religion or whatever. And they have to be buried within the day that they die. So they took him to one of the islands where we were and buried him on this island. I mean, the padre went and all that, so there was some little ceremony. But there wasn't a guard of honour or anything like that. I mean, we were in North Korean waters. Because funny enough, last year Brad King took it up that this Chinese steward who was in the British Navy, in the Royal Navy, was buried on this island, and he sought to have his body moved from this island to one of the military cemeteries in South Korea. And they found that the North Korean army had built a big military installation on this island, so he'd probably been unearthed, or I don't know whether they would rebury him or just bury the bones, you know.
Anything else about those missions, or that mission, the first mission? Well, it's a series of firing up and down the coast, isn't it?
Yeah, there was other things. I mean, this is not just the first mission, this is during the commission. That
it became a routine, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, purely routine. That in the end, quite often, they didn't even go to action stations. They go to defence stations, level, whatever, which meant we didn't all have to close up. Mainly the air gunners. Although we were never attacked by aeroplanes, because the Americans dominated the skies. And other things that happened. I remember our LCP went ashore for something.
LCP meaning?
Landing Craft Personnel. It was a little thing they picked up at the end of the war in Australia. It was an American boat. And the Aussies had it, and they gave it to the Belfast, and our people did it up, and it was a nice boat, actually. That was going ashore. That was always manned by Royal Marines with a stoker. And the two blokes who manned it for the whole commission were both friends of mine. Eric Framingham, who died in 87, and Sharkey Ward was the other stoker, because they work 24 about. And I see Sharky Ward every Wednesday we meet up the ship. So he often talks about the LCP. But it went ashore for something. They were looking for something. And it came under fire from the North Korean soldiers who were on this beach, or hiding off the beach. And they opened fire on them. Marine Coffin stood on the side and fired back, and they shot him through the calf of his right leg, I think it was. It's one of his legs. And the boat just turned around and came out. Another time, they took two Marines, Sergeant